My name is Clancy Emerson. I'm an alcoholic. I'm very glad to be here tonight. I'm kind of excited to be here on such a busy night. Elections and reports, and I really haven't got to the meat of my talk yet. I'm used to peeling off a little later, you know. I want to congratulate your new secretary. I've known her for some time, and she's a dear girl, and I hope she will do a good job. There's nothing like seeing democracy in action to really get a feeling. Let's see, the train crash probably ran right out there. But we do share something, all of us, in common. That is, we are here, hopefully, I suppose, because we have a baffling and puzzling malady. Most of us come here believing it is not anything that can be solved by such common therapies as is found in AA. Most of us come here feeling rather complex and rather beaten down and rather like a fawn in the forest fire. Just everywhere you go, there's another burning branch. There's just nowhere to go. And you hear people who have gotten sober and feel wonderful. I was thinking tonight, I'm sure they mean it, and I'm sure they are truthful about it, but I'm sure it is not completely accurate. So those of you who are new, our first few birthday people got up and said how it gets better every day, day after day. That's kind of an overview. It really doesn't. If we didn't, we wouldn't need these damn meetings. We'd just all go home and sit there and wallow in it. Oh. Go down to the club once a week and drain off some serenity. There's no question that you should feel better after you're here, but the problem here seems to be manifested by a roller coaster type of operation. And when it has only two bad parts. One is up at the top and one's at the bottom. And outside of that is the snap. When you're at the top, you don't need it. When you're at the bottom, it isn't enough. You know? And so we gather together on a continuing basis to, why don't you do that during the coffee break? Now you've embarrassed me and humiliated me. Why didn't you ask you to do it during the coffee break? I'll tell you a little worse thing than that. I had some of my about 1966 at the Southern California Convention. I had a group of new guys with me. Tom Whalen, Ken Hodges, Jim Shaw, all these people are all old sober pukes now, but they're all newcomers that year. And I was in the 1960s, as you remember, was kind of a hippie-filled year, and people were dropping out. And we sat in this convention. There were people there, you know, oh, man, so cool. And is that the year you got sober, Paul? Oh, was it really? 67. Maybe it was 67, because I know. After I got done with these pukes, somebody asked me if I would talk to you, Junior. You remember that? Well, he hates to admit it, but he'd like to have you think he sprung full-blown out of the forehead of Zeus, but he really didn't. But anyway, they had this dance, and I was sitting there trying to instill my newcomers with right-wing fascist pig AA perceptions, and everybody, so half the people were cool, and I saw a few crowd about like this. Guy coming through, this was 10 o'clock at night. Here comes a guy with some shades coming through the crowd, you know. I said, here's an example. Here's what you can watch out for. Look at here. Look at the guy coming across the room with the shades. Nighttime, 10 o'clock at night. It was so damn important that he seemed cool. And he got a little closer. Sun's gone down. And he didn't even wince. He just walked by our table with he and his seeing eye dog.
Oh,
lot of pain over the years. I don't know why I'm in such a... I guess I'm, as I get older, I tell stories. I'm going into my anecdotage, as the saying goes. But one of the things that brings about, I don't think I ever told this on the podium before, but some years ago, there was a guy named Harvey Andrews who was 10 years sober and went through kind of a suicidal thing. He made it because he's 33 now, but he called me up in the middle and I said, I think I'm going to commit suicide. He went to my house at 4 in the morning and he sat and drank coffee. By this time, whatever the bad dream was or whatever dissipated. About 6 or 7 in the morning, he was feeling kind of cocky again. And I said, well, everybody get to work. Let's get ready and go to work now. And he said, yeah, thanks. Thanks for sitting up with me. And the way I put his, my arm around his back, I said, Harvey, don't worry. You're not going to die. You'll be around to pee on my grave. He said, Clancy, I would never do that. And I was kind of touched. Maybe there's some sincerity in the world. I said, why do you say that, Harvey? He says, when I got out of the Army, I swore I'd never stand in line again. And if you think that's called getting better every day, day after day. I suppose the biggest problem... Now, today there's AA everywhere, and most people know these facts. You're nothing staggering about them. There's AA everywhere, all over the world. And the heart of AA, of course, is the United States. The heart of AA in the United States is Southern California. This is really the fountainhead of AA worldwide right now. There are more sober AAs in Southern California than New York and Illinois combined, for example. And there is just an ongoing... All of the other, most of the major offshoots of AA, the before they get into the fringe ones like adult pets of children of alcoholics. Watch them, they bite. They come from a dysfunctional kennel. But most of the major, like GA and OA and NA and Cocaine Anonymous and even Sex Anonymous, all came out of L.A. They all came out of the West L.A. area. People active in AA who wanted to get other, bring this message to other people. Now, of course, there are some 240 organizations using the 12 steps. Now, some are just ridiculous. They really are, because, you know, the point is this, that the steps are nice to sit and talk about. It makes everybody feel good. But they're very hard to continue to motivate people to keep doing. It's an amazing thing. Some people just... We see people die all the time because they won't do them. And if the people who are dying won't do them, what chance you got of motivating someone on a, because you think that'd be a good idea? One of the great examples, you know, you go up to the county hospital in Los Angeles, the alcoholic ward, where people are lying there and their eyeballs are yellow and their liver sticks out to here and they're just dying. And you have an AA meeting. So come on to the AA meeting, pal. Nope. No, you have your little Alcoholics Anonymous meeting. I don't, I'm not that bad. And you come back next month and they're dead. There's somebody new in the bed who has a reason not to go to the meeting. Of dying people. And you contravene that and say, well, if we only get this message to people early, get to people when they're desperate. I see desperate people all the time. Unlike most people in this room, probably all of you, when I go to work tomorrow morning, I will step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my office. And when I go home tomorrow night, I'll step over the bodies of dying men and women to get to my car. And you think I'd communicate that the fact that there's Alcoholics Anonymous to these people, and I do, but nearly all of them have been to AA and know and feel confident it doesn't work for them. And they will be dead this week, or next month, or next year. And somebody else will be laying there explaining that they've been to AA. Everybody's been to AA. All the long-term drinkers I know, just about, that at least that are The flamboyant, obvious drinkers have been to AA at one time or another. And they know it doesn't work. Because their case is different. Because they have a different problem. And the nature of that same is the problem is exactly the same thing that you and I carry within us. I talked about this a little bit at Laguna Beach a couple weeks ago. If you were there and I'm boring you, I hope not. But it is so germane to why we are here. If there's anything I suppose that all of us have in common, among other things, is that low-level feeling that my case truly is different. Now, you may not have that feeling tonight, but you wait until the next time you're cross or tired or hungry or someone's made you feel bad, you'll see that feeling come back. They don't understand my case. But that isn't fatal, because if it were fatal, we'd all be dead, because everybody has it that I've ever seen. But left unattended, it can grow and become fatal. It's like, truly is like a cancer. It grows, it nourishes off the host and grows and kills it. And it provides an absolute shield that nothing can get through. It's invisible, but it's there. You know, no words, no information, no data can get through. That's why AA's always traditionally been kind of not very deeply into unasked for information, because people are not receptive to it. Any more receptive than Bill Wilson was to Ebby calling on him and telling him what he had found years ago. And left, what we do here, among other things, is take people like you and me, and among other actions we take are actions to keep this feeling of difference at a non-lethal level. Because once it becomes lethal, then there's nothing here that can help you. I know AA works. Nobody ever questions that. But it doesn't work for people like me. It works for people like them, whose problem is alcohol, and whose lives are disorganized, and they come here, and they find a way to stop drinking, and they shape up their lives, and they live happily ever after, apparently. But I'm not like that. I discovered a long time ago, I have deep and complex emotions that I cannot always control and govern. I have feelings that I can sometimes even look at them. It's almost as though part of my head is looking at it and saying, Jesus, that's a goofy emotion, but you're still caught up in it. Of being too sensitive sometimes, being so subject to terrible feelings that people can inculcate, of having such spells of anxiety and feelings of insecurity and feelings of loneliness and feelings of resentment towards unfairness and feelings and on and on and on. Now, I don't always have all of these feelings. They come and go, but when they come, they are grabbers. And it always seemed to me in my self-examinations that there's something different about me, and it has something to do with my feelings. And I got to find out why it is. I spent thousands and thousands of dollars in psychoanalysis, and I discovered reasons that seemed appropriate to me. It turned out I'd been things I hadn't even guessed. I've been psychologically scarred by the Norwegian Lutheran Church. That's kind of guess you don't know about the Norwegian Lutheran Church. As the old saying goes, even when the Norwegian Lutheran Church, even if you're married 30 years, you never would make love standing up with your wife. Just in the fear that some passerby might think you were dancing. I discovered that I had been deprived as a child of the Depression. Didn't even know there had been a depression until I heard that, but when I found out, I was very upset. Found out, a lot of things. And I got into metaphysics another time. I worked very hard at this. I was about half crazy now, so I really had a head start. I was deeply into the gradual fruition of the oneness of the infinite and finite self. At one time, I don't like to gloat. I mean, But at one time, to the best of my knowledge, I was one of six people in the state of Texas who knew truth. And you would think they'd admire you, wouldn't you? But they put me in the insane asylum is what they did. I read books. I did a lot of things. But the biggest help I ever had in my life, I never paid any attention to. I discovered I was a boy 15 years old on a ship in Pearl Harbor early in the Second World War, that a few drinks, if you could hold them down, made you feel the way men look. And I never found anything else that ever did it. Alcohol, a few drinks will make you feel the way men look faster than any therapy I know. If you are like me, a year of psychoanalysis will not make you feel as well as a few drinks. A few drinks will make you feel better than an understanding of the metaphysical oneness of the universe. A few drinks will make you feel better than an understanding of the Nietzschean theory of the Übermensch. A few drinks, I guess to sum it up, takes people who don't feel quite enough and makes them feel something more than enough. A few drinks takes people who have gone through their life with their armor open, feeling vulnerable, and makes them feel temporarily invulnerable. It takes people who are feeling afraid and gives them feelings of momentary omnipotence. And if it does that, it's just great. And I could understand why people drank. And I had, later in the war, I tried to learn how to drink a little better. And after the end of the war, I was in a naval hospital in California, up in the Pleasanton, being sewed up. But I took some tests. I was still a junior in high school, but I got a high school equivalency and went to the university after the war and got married, went out in the world, became a sports writer. Then I got advertising and public relations and held some good jobs up and down. And the only problems I had two major problems in all these years. My emotions. One of the great emotions of my life, I never identified until I was sober several years. I heard a guy tell it to me in his inventory. And I almost pushed one of the cars to think that goof could identify a feeling that I couldn't. That ranks right up there with the feeling of when you worked with someone and told them how to stay sober and give them insights and understandings, and he can't stay sober. And you see him 6 months later, he stayed sober. I met Fred down at the center, and he gave me the secret. What is it? Well, don't drink and go to a lot of meetings. You almost wish people like that would move somewhere else. They're playing our song. Yeah. Would you save me the last dance, Elsa? But the feeling that was so paramount and so omnipresent in my life was, I never even identified it. It's just a low-level feeling of unease. Just kind of, this isn't it either. This is not the job I wanted. This is not really the place I want to be. These are not the people I visualize myself with. This is not it either. It's almost like eating food that doesn't have any salt. It's nourishing, but it isn't what I had in mind. And I discovered in life that life is full of a lot of blacks and whites and grays, and life gets to be drab. And I almost want things to be wonderful. I know they can't always stay wonderful, but I kind of like to find things that are wonderful and add a little zest and a little technicolor to this gray world. And I would find things that were wonderful. Then they would gradually disappoint me and they'd turn black and white. I was sober sometime before I began to understand the nature of that phenomenon. And I think it's, everyone's involved in it. And I think if you're new, it's kind of nice to hear it. And that is this. Nothing is wonderful after you're used to it. Nothing is wonderful after you. It can become deep and rich and grand, but it doesn't have that teenage tingling that we're looking for. The new car just one day becomes the goddamn old car. That's got a rattle in the hood somewhere. And the new job finally becomes just a job where they're acting goofy. And the new love, if we're going to change anything, just dissipates a little bit. I remember telling newcomers when they talk to you about how this is, I was going to be good about this, but as they call up, say, I want to talk to you about my new relationship. And if you really think fast, you can say, oh, Mr. Imus on the end of the day, he go home a long time ago. They all got the same story. Sometimes they're 22 and sometimes they're 68, but it's the same goddamn story. All right. I know I probably told you about other girls, but this is the one, really. When I saw her come walking out of that detox, we had lunch at the club, and we reached for the salt, and our fingers touched. I swear there was a spark, a real spark. And you don't know whether to tell them the bad news or not, is that nothing ever stays this way. Wish it would, but it doesn't. You may get married to this woman someday. The chances are 8 million to 1, but say it does. And you get married, have 2 wonderful children, and live happily ever after. It isn't going to stay this way. 3 years from now, you're going to be sitting having lunch in your new home, and you're going to reach for the salt. Your fingers are going to touch. You're going to say, give me the goddamn salt. But when you're perpetually immature, you feel you've been betrayed when this happens. What's happened to you? There's no spark anymore when our fingers touch. Get out, bitch. Really childish. I think, you know, there's some school of alcoholics I've heard that get into a movement where they're trying to get in touch with their inner child, or to get the inner child out of them. I've had just the opposite. I've got an inner adult I'm trying to get out. I just... I haven't had a happy childhood, but it's been a long one. Just I may be the only one next year going down to the Social Security office to file for Social Security and singing, M-I-C-A-U-R. But I like things to have a little life and zip. And of themselves, they don't stay. And I discovered a long time ago that a few drinks adds a little zip. It adds a little tingling to life. One of the great lines of all literature, the end of Days of White and Roses. Incidentally, that book, Days of White and Roses, and later the TV program, later the movie, is just incredible. The guy who wrote that, a guy named J.P. Miller, is not and has never been an alcoholic. I don't know how in the world he ever got the... He got a keen ear to hear the senses. Because one of the great lines of all time, at the end of the guy's, his wife, when he started drinking, now she's drunk and he's going to AA, and they got a little girl staying with him. She says, won't you go to AA? Please, give it a try. Stop drinking. And she takes him to the window and says, no. She says, you know how I am. I'm so sensitive to things. I need things to be lovely. She says, look at that alley down there. I'm sober now. And there's mud puddles and filth and dirt. And I can't stand it. But when I drink, I just see the reflections in the water. She says, I love my little girl more than my life, but I'd go insane to be here with her sober. And well, she goes out to drink herself to death. Is that the way life is in this organization? And these things. And it's so hard because people say, well, you seem to have a drinking problem. Why don't you stop drinking? And you may go along with it for a while, but you discover it doesn't work really for people like me. It works for people like them who have a drinking problem and they straighten out their lives. But when I get sober, if not right away, pretty soon my old pal has come back in the middle of the night, despair and loneliness and fear and feelings of terrible difference. People say to me, well, if you'd stop drinking and go to these meetings, you'd be all right. And I want to just shout at them. If you think that's the case, why don't you go over to my house, sneak into my bedroom some night about 2 o'clock in the morning when I'm cold sober. Maybe you can stand there and watch me in the dark, lie on my pillow, just look off in the darkness, my head going a million miles an hour, and think, God, what went wrong? Why am I not getting along with my kids? I love them. Why is my job screwed up? I mean, why are people doing this? Why don't people like me? Why do they like each other all the time, but they don't like me, really? What's on and on? If you watch that for a while, you won't think drinking's my problem. You'll understand why I drink. Because when I drink, it assuages those feelings. It takes fear and makes it momentary omnipotence. And I may be kidding myself. Who cares? I get sick of being nothing and being racked. My problem is I have a tendency to drink too much. Because I like it so well and I like the feeling. I want to hold the feeling. I drink too much. And then I sometimes drink too much and get in trouble. And then well-meaning people are convinced I have a drinking problem. I was sent to my first AA meeting in 1949. That's a long time before some of you were born. And I was 22. Now, 22 isn't very young in AA now, but it was terribly young. Nobody heard of anybody within 20 years of it, 15 or 20 years of it. They just thought I was a bunch of little freak there for some unknown reason. And I thought they were a bunch of burned-out old fools and I had no identification with them. But I hung around and got the message of AA. You don't drink and you shape up your life and you feel better. And I tried it. And it doesn't work for people like me. So the next few years I went to psychoanalysis and metaphysics and read books and went to work and tried various self-therapies and self-disciplines. And at the end of it, the final explosion, after a series of explosions that I could muffle, the explosion came, I couldn't muffle it, it all went away, and the top of my personal Mount St. Helens mountain blew away, and I found myself being thrown out of a skid row mission in Los Angeles. I tried to explain to the guy, I'm not a bum. 3 years ago, I directed a grand opera at the University of Texas. Ads that I wrote with some other guys, Elsie and Elmer ads for the Borden Company, are running this very week in Life Magazine and Collier's and Saturday Evening Post. I've had my picture in the New York Times for achievement. How many people do you know have had their picture in the New York Times for achievement? But it's hard to explain these things in midair, you know. And I had my front teeth kicked out of the Phoenix jail about a month before that, so I was not hitting those consonants quite as cleanly as ever. In fact, I think of all the people in this room, maybe Mary R. back there is the only one who ever saw me without my front teeth that's in this room. But I learned to carry my lip like this pretty well. Every time I got some money, my sponsor made me send it to my kids. And a lot of people didn't know that I didn't have front teeth. They just thought I'd been burned in a fire. I walked out to the AA club at the corner of Wilshire and Fairfax, where Orbach now stands. I lurked around there. I'd been asked to leave there a couple weeks before for being in a drunken fight. I hung around that club and I felt so bad I can't tell you how bad I felt. Not only the badness of being physically ill, that's all right, but the humiliation. And I just came to the conclusion, there's no sense even pretending anymore. I'm going to be nothing. I might as well be dead. I am hopeless. There's no sense even having a front anymore. And I didn't realize that in so doing that, I was making myself amenable to recovery. I don't think that you have to be on Skid Row to be amenable to recovery by any means. But you have to get to a point where you got to somehow surrender deep within yourself, Jesus, I cannot find a reasonable way to think that I can think of that I'm going to get better. Every plan I've tried has worked for a little while, but it's one more pitiful and incomprehensible demoralization. And what that did for me, that I now view it as some sort of a psychic surrender. So I think the surrender you have to do here, we talk about surrender, but the hardest surrender you have to do is down deep. You must surrender your judgment of what is right for you. God, that's a tough one. And we got to keep doing it again and again, because as soon as you get feeling strong, you want to grab it back. And I therefore allowed myself to be ordered around by a dictator-type sponsor, and who intimidated me and inflicted actions on me that I thought I took to be humiliating and just hurt me terribly, made me feel resentment and pain and fear and despair because they were so inane. But over a period of time, I began to get better, much against every concept that I believed in. And I have not had a drink since, nor have I had any therapy since of any kind except this therapy. And I've been very fortunate in that I'm joking a little bit about being immature, but in a sense that's been very good for me. I'm not sure that I want to be mature, because being immature as I am, I can't get very far away from AA without noticing it. I mean, I used to, when I was newer, think, God, wouldn't it be wonderful to be like these people? They go to one meeting in 3 months and they just seem to be all right. I mean, just fine. They come to one meeting a month. But I noticed as the years went by, many of them go right to the cliff. They don't run through the cliff, but over they go. And the one thing that's been good for AA for me is that I don't have to stay away very long before I get the great opening signs that there's something terribly amiss. You know what that is? I don't change. Everybody around me starts to turn into an asshole. I wish I had a nicer word for it, but that's what they turn into. I want to apologize, Mrs. C, but I never meant you. I meant Paul. I didn't mean you, Max. Just go like this. I'll give you a seal. And the worst thing about that is I'm convinced I'm right and I can prove what's wrong with it, what's wrong with AA. And the greatest example of that I saw in my sponsor when I was 2.5 years sober. They changed the format of the Pacific Palisades meeting that he started without telling. And he got cross and he stopped going to meetings. And I said to him, Jesus, Bob, you ought to go to some meetings. And in fact, I had a spooky thing tonight. A spooky thing happened. I was driving down here, listening to the radio on the freeway, and my sponsor was on the radio, my first sponsor. He's been dead since 1961. But at KNX, they play old radio programs, and he had a series in which he was a guy, and a detective. And I just turned out, oh, there's that voice. I thought, oh, my God, he's coming to see if I'm going to be on time. But he got mad, and he didn't go to AA, and he decided he'd share his wisdom with Synanon and help them. So we went down there, and eventually he drank, and eventually he died drunk. And people said to me, God, that must be terrible for you, because you know, you're not very stable anyway. Now your sponsor's died drunk. You're going to push you over the edge. And I tell him, no, I don't think so. He just convinced me that everything he said was true, because he always told me, if you don't do these things, eventually you're going to get drunk and die. And he just showed me how it happened. So some little while after that, I got another sponsor. And this time I didn't get a sponsor who was a dictator or anything else. I got a sponsor. By that time, a point where I understood what AA was. I looked around me and I looked ahead of me. I wanted to find the most active Alcoholics Anonymous member I could find if I could. And that's to be my sponsor, because of myself, I have a tendency to be lazy and lag, and someone who pulled me along. And I found a guy in Laguna Beach, and he asked to be my sponsor, and I had already become rather arrogant and betrayed. He answered me by saying, "Oh, I thought you'd come over to offer to be my sponsor." And he was my sponsor for almost a quarter of a century. Because I've never lost my absolute feeling that the purpose of Alcoholics Anonymous, and the theory, at least for people like me, is action and continual steps to get out of self. That is how I tend the feeling of difference. But what has all this got to do with alcohol? The thing is this. We all have to learn here. I have to learn here. You may have it in different ways. But the biggest message I ever got in AA, after I was sober some time, I came to believe I was an alcoholic. After I was in AA some time. Because I finally began to put together, and I think as much as we say we don't do it that way, but we need a little intellectual rationale. You can only follow mysticism so long, then it gets dreary. It's fun to follow it for a while, but then one day, oh Jesus, you know. No more existential insights today. I'm going to miss my bus. You got to have some pragmatism. And much to my surprise and joy, this became a very pragmatic thing when I began to put together the pieces, you know. And there are, you don't get all the pieces. I can tell you all they wanted, but use this analogy before. It's like putting together a jigsaw puzzle, you know. You go to a meeting and you get a piece. You say, "Oh, look what I found. It. I don't know what it is, but it really is a good speaker." Then you find another speaker. "Oh, that's a good one. It, well, it doesn't fit that one, but..." And this goes on forever, just piece after piece. Nothing ever fits, but it's all good. And one night you find that you get a big piece, and that one fits over there. It starts to, it's a horsey. Then it gets easy. "Oh shit, I know I can put you up in the water." It's a hell of a time finding that horsey to find, you know. I had to come to understand finally that what I thought would make me ineligible for Alcoholics Anonymous is the thing that made me eligible. Despite what I always heard, the problem here is not alcohol. If your problem is alcohol, you're not only not an alcoholic, you shouldn't be wasting your time coming to these meetings. The problem is something that sounds like alcohol, and we talk a lot about drinking here, but it's easily confusing. It's something called alcoholism. Alcohol, alcoholism, same thing. Not the same thing. Big difference. If you be like us, I'll guarantee the day will come when your life and sanity will inevitably depend on remembering the difference. There's a lot of differences you can discuss, but what it boils down to pragmatically is this. An alcohol problem is overcome by stopping drinking and shaping up. In this strange, denigrating, destructive, emotionally eroding, eventually fatal thing called alcoholism, you will discover sooner or later that stopping drinking as such has no significant effect on your life other than to gradually make it so emotionally painful you can't stand it. That's what makes alcoholism such a deadly disease, because the apparent recovery from it is the fatal end. Sobriety is eventually unbearable. But even that doesn't make an alcoholic. A lot of people have those feelings. They're not alcoholics. They go to psychiatrists, they take Garvon and Librium and Valium because they're intense neurotics. They need help. But they will never be alcoholics because of one other thing. It turns out every generation, nobody knows why, but about 5 or 6% of people who drink get an unnatural reaction from alcohol. They don't know it's an unnatural reaction. And nobody around knows they're getting it. You have nothing, no way to measure. A lot of people think when you stay drunk, that's the unnatural reaction. That you act crazy. Some people do, some people don't. That you can't handle it. All alcoholics handle alcohol better than non-alcoholics in any kind of way.
The unusual thing is the one thing I always took for granted. Only the 5 or 6% of people get the feeling that it takes them from being not quite enough into being more than enough. It takes fight for people and making them momentarily it takes lonely people to make them and vulnerable people make them look temporarily invulnerable. So what alcoholism does, it redresses this tremendous emotional imbalance. It gives you the emotional imbalance the other way, almost a euphoria. And then you drink too much. People, no one's ever made a satisfactory answer that I've ever heard about. And I know satisfied this theory of craving. I have my own theory on that. I have it for a while, and I believe it, at least for people like me, to be true. At least the truth is anything. That is this. When you're feeling so bad and you drink, that regresses that terrible emotion out. Oh, it's almost like an orgasmic experience sometimes. You just need that drink so bad. And then it starts to fade, really. It starts to fade. It's a quick fading. So you have another drink to hold it. You have another drink to hold it. You hold it. Keep drinking to hold it. And pretty soon you're drunk. I don't want to be drunk. I want to be holding it as if... And so I'm sure the guys in this room, the girls, have done what I've done. Especially my early days. Go in the washroom. Put your finger on your throat. Throw up. So you won't be drunk. So you can enjoy it. But you can't enjoy it very long. One day you're drunk. I mean, 1 hour you're drunk. And pretty soon you're drunk. And then you got to go through it. People say, why did you drink? I can't answer. I don't know. Why did you get drunk? I don't know the reason. Leave me alone. They never found out until I was sober sometime. I drank it because it gave me the only feeling in my life that made me feel whole. And the reason that's important to understand, so you won't fall into that little category of people who come here, a big category, I think AA is a place to get sober and straighten up. Being sober and straightened up will help you throughout, but one day the pain will begin and it will never stop. And you'll be like the literally millions of people who have been to AA and convinced and left. And they're convinced that they're desperate. Alcoholics Anonymous does not work for people like me. I've been there and I was sober. And they realize they've never tried AA. Being sober is the front porch of Alcoholics Anonymous. You just stand on the front porch out of the rain. When it starts to hurt, you can consider your difference and run. Or you can hopefully listen to what you hear here. Sometimes. And step through the door into the house. That's what AA is. That's where you find commitments and involvements and little by little change actions and hopefully a sponsor that you can surrender your judgment to in moments of pain and just despair. And eventually as a result of that, take 12 steps. That much to your surprise will change your perception of reality a little bit. My greatest fight with my greatest disappointment in the treatment centers today, I think, they issue, they send people out the streets thinking they've taken the 12 steps in those 28 days. And you try to work with them and they don't hear about the steps. And it's all kind of funny until they keep drinking until they die. Then this is funny anymore. Because they're convinced they've tried AA. You can't work these steps in 28 days or 28 weeks or 28 months or 28 years because they're ongoing things. That will be able to keep regressing, regressing, regressing almost every, so almost continual, like driving the car. You could be going perfectly south like I was tonight in the car for long stretches. I can't hold my hands like this. It's a continual. Oh, let me drive. That's what the steps are. And finally, hopefully you will come to understand that you are not so different. And you will continue to take the maintenance sources that will keep your feelings of difference at least as a passing emotion, not as an obsessive, lethal instrument of your own destruction. See, as you get better, you face conflicts, you face upsets, you have to learn to deal with it. So in a sense, it does always get better. But in a real sense, it doesn't get better like this, you know. That's why it gets better at birthdays. When it does get, you don't get sick like this. You get sick like this. Oh, God. Oh, my. I think I got it under control. Now I've changed from beer to, oh, Jesus. And when you get better, it doesn't go like this. It goes, Oh, I'm on a new program of life and a way of living. Oh, Jesus Christ. Make amends for that bitch.
But this is the first retreat I've ever attended. I've never attended a retreat before. And I didn't want to attend this one because I've always had kind of a subconscious joking attitude towards retreats of, I know how to retreat, I'm trying to find a way to go forward.
That's why it's an ongoing program, and that's why the people who have been lucky enough to discover the pragmatic recovery stay here. And the only battle you have after that is you start feeling comfortable and your mind says you don't need to do that stuff anymore. It's inconvenient. Now you have to fight the same battle from the other side of the spectrum. And you must stay active and involved and never too busy to pat someone on behind you and get to start. Then A is all that's packed up to me. Some days life is tough. Some days it's simple. Some days life is full of tinglings. So some days it's a gray day. But you know, it all evens out. It's the best deal we've got. I am I became somewhat successful after I was sober a while. Got back into radio and television, and another guy and I created something called Boss Radio and became the number one hard rock station in the world. And all were shiny seats, did a lot of things. And I did quite well. My family moved out here, and when I was 15 years sober, I stayed active too long because I changed more than I'd planned. And one day I found myself leaving a job in Beverly Hills, and for the last 17 years I run the Skid Row mission that threw me out in 1958. And some mornings I get up like a little, innocent really sounds like a wonderful altruistic person. And not at all. I get up in the morning, a lot of mornings, and think, I just don't want to go down and see them. Living death and sick. I want to get off in Robertson and go to my office at Robertson where that pretty blonde used to pour me coffee and press buzzers and make people jump. When I drive home at night, I feel more requited than I ever did coming down the elevator from Beverly Hills. So I guess I'll keep doing this some more. Now if you're new tonight, and we've got a lot of new people, don't misunderstand me. Even if you work the program and stay sober 15 years, we can't guarantee you to give you your own mission, There's only so many to go around. I've got mine. But we can guarantee you that you will live in the world with more dignity than you ever thought possible. And then it's worthwhile. Thank you.